Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
It's a great pleasure for me to introduce Anton DiScalafini, who wrote this wonderful book, The Yanalasi Writing Camp for Girls. It's a great story set in the 30s, and it's an equestrian writing camp for girls where Thea has been kind of sent in the middle of the Blue Ridge Mountains because of things that have happened with her family in Florida. And Thea's been described as sort of the Scarlett O'Hara type, this book was also compared with A Separate Piece, which I got that. I thought that was really nice. So please welcome Anton DiScalafini.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction, and thank you to the Tattered Cover for hosting me. I am going to keep my reading fairly brief, and then if you have questions, I'm happy to answer them. So the book is, to give you a little background, the book is set in the 1930s, and the main character, Thea Atwell, whose point of view I'll read in, is sent away from her home in Florida for an unknown transgression. You have to read to find out. And she is sent to this place called the Yanalasi Writing Camp for Girls. The Yanalasi Writing Camp for Girls, it wasn't called that. It was called Camp Yanalasi. It was a real place in the Blue Ridge Mountains. It ran from 1923 to 1985, and it was the oldest running girls camp in North Carolina when it closed in 1985. So I was 4 when it closed, so I didn't go there. But my family has a cabin in Blowing Rock, which is where it's located, and I grew up seeing the signs for Yanalasi. So there's like businesses have co-opted it, the name. There's a Yanalasi tennis club and a Yanalasi restaurant in a subdivision. So it was a real place, and I very purposely did very little research into the real place because I didn't want to feel beholden to it, and I didn't want angry campers. Which I got some anyway, but most of them were not. So I'm going to read from the beginning of the book. And I don't think you need to know much except that this is the first time she's seen Yanalasi. But then I knew nothing about the place except that it was where my parents were sending me so they wouldn't have to see me. It was dusk when we arrived, a melancholy hour I've always hated. Under the cover of enormous oak trees, we drove up the long gravel road that seemed to go on forever. It occurred to me that it might be weeks before I traveled this road again. My father clutched the wheel and squinted, completing very carefully the task at hand, which was how he had always done things. We pulled up to a square. It was indeed called a square, I would later learn, of birch-shingled cabins, and my father began to turn the automobile off. I looked around for another girl, but there was no one. I opened my own door. Thea, my father called, but I ignored him. I set my feet on the loamy soil, so different from the ground in Florida now, which was parched from the summer. The air smelled wet here, but not like the ocean. The ocean was always close to you in Florida, even when you lived hours away, like we did. Here you were boxed in, on all sides, by mountains. I peered up at the building in front of me while my father fiddled with a car. He would not leave it until he was sure everything was turned off properly. Even now. Even now. And this building was something like I had never seen before, half built into the mountain. The stilts that supported it reminded me of horses' legs, tall and wobbly, not meant to sustain such weight. I always had the feeling that the building should fall, would fall. Later, so much later, our headmaster told me that this was, in fact, the safest way to build in the mountains. I never believed him. Since it was Sunday, the camp had already eaten dinner, but I didn't know that then, and I was overcome by a terrible sensation of dread and longing. This was not my home. My family was elsewhere. A man approached, appearing as if out of thin air, and held out his hand when he was still much too far away, 10-12 feet, for my father to possibly accept it. I thought for an instant that he resembled my brother. "I'm Henry Holmes," he called out, "the headmaster." The first thing I thought about Henry Holmes was that his title was odd. I didn't know summer camp's headmasters. Then he reached us, and first my father shook his hand. Next, Mr. Holmes held the tips of my fingers and bowed slightly. I inclined my head. "Thea," my father said. "Theodora, but call her Thea." I nodded and blushed. I was not used to strangers, and Mr. Holmes was handsome, with dark, glossy brown hair that looked in need of a trim. His shirt sleeves were neatly rolled up, and now that he was close, I could see that he did not, in fact, resemble Sam. Sam had a happy, open face with round, hazel eyes. Mother's eyes. Sam always looked kind, calm. Mr. Holmes's face was a tiny bit tense, his lips drawn together in consideration. And he was a man with a shadow of a beard. My brother was a boy. At that moment, I would have seen Sam's face in anyone's. I had taken one of his monogrammed handkerchiefs, which was what the adults I read about in books did, gave their loved ones a memento. But of course, Sam had not given me anything. I had taken it. The handkerchief lay flat against my torso, beneath my dress. No one in the world knew it was there but me. I pressed my hand to my stomach and looked Mr. Holmes in the eye, as my mother had taught me to do with strangers. I couldn't ever remember meeting a man whom I was not related to, though surely I must have. "We're pleased you've decided to join us," he said, and his voice seemed softer when he spoke to me, as if he were trying to show sympathy not with the words but with the way they sounded when they reached my ears. I told him that I was pleased to be here as well. He must have guessed that some unpleasantness had sent me to the camp so late in season. I was enrolling in the middle of the summer. I wondered what excuse my father had made. Mr. Holmes led us up the tall staircase to the castle, and though I would only learn later that this was what everyone called this edifice, I thought even then that it looked like a fortress, imposing and elegant. The staircase was uncovered, and it must have just rained, because the wood was slick. I stepped carefully. 2 gas lamps flanked the door at the top of the stairs. The twin flames burned steadily, orange and red within their glass houses. Mr. Holmes opened a thick oak door, painted navy blue with yellow trim, the camp's colors, and led us through the front room, which served as the dining hall and worship site. "So unlike Florida," my father said. He smiled at me, and I could see that he was pained. He had started to gray around the temples in the past year, and I saw, suddenly, that my father would become old. Mr. Holmes waved us into his office, where I sat on a brown velvet settee, while my father and Mr. Holmes took care of the necessary matters. I could feel Mr. Holmes watching me, but I did not look up. I coughed, and my father turned his head. "Wait outside, Thea?" I left and wandered down the hall outside the office. From where I stood, I could see the tables that were already set for the next meal. Tables that tomorrow morning would surely be filled with girls, hundreds of them. I wanted so badly to be elsewhere. I turned back to Mr. Holmes' office and was confronted by a wall of photographs, which I had somehow missed before. Horses, and astride them, their girls. I went closer and read the tiny script engraved beneath each photo, touched the brass and felt the words. On each plaque, there was the name of a horse, and beneath that, the name of a girl, and then finally, first place, spring show, and the year. There were photos from the 1800s. The horses hadn't changed much, but the earliest girls rode side saddle, their legs hobbled together, hanging uselessly. You could see the march of time, both through the quality of the photographs and the girls' names and clothes and hairstyles. The last two had grown shorter as time progressed. So many people had passed through this place. The most recent photograph featured a tall girl with white blonde hair and patrician features, astride a giant horse. They dwarfed the man who stood next to them, presenting the award. Leona Keller, it read, King's Dominion, first place, spring show, 1930. I noticed a small marble top table by Mr. Holmes' office door, two neat stacks of brochures on top of it. Janalasi Riding Camp for Girls, the first one said. A summer equestrian respite for young ladies since 1876. Beneath the cursive script was a row of smiling girls in white blouses and white skirts, each holding a horse. The horse's ears were all flipped forward, their attention earned by something behind the camera. At first, I thought the brochures in the next stack were simply older versions. Their covers featured a photograph of what must have been the entire student body, a mass of girls straightened into rows for a picture, each one of them staring solemnly into the camera. Janalasi Riding School for Girls, the same cursive script read, educating young ladies since 1902. I heard a voice behind Mr. Holmes's door and slipped away and went to the window. I held a hand to the glass, my thumb blocked half of a mountain range. The view was stunning. I had never seen anything like it. Florida was flat and hot. As far as I could see from this window, there were mountain peaks, slate gray, snaked with trees, puncturing the clouds that hung so low they must not have been ordinary clouds. The clouds I was used to floated high in the sky. I was not so angry with my situation that I could not discern beauty. Thank you. Great. So I'm happy to answer questions if you have any, but it's okay if you don't. I mean, it's okay. That's not to say that it's okay if you do too. It's fun if you do. Anybody? Yes, Paula. Okay, that's okay. The negotiation between the two. Yeah, I think that changes with your second novel. I always wanted to publish the book. Like, I wasn't writing as an exercise, which a lot of people do, and it's great. But I the goal was to get the book published. So that said, I wasn't thinking at all about what would be appealing to people and what people would like. And, they just weren't kind of concerns in my head. But what I was writing did align with, what publishers thought that like people would be interested in, which I really wasn't thinking, but it's like a boarding school and it has horses in it, which apparently people like to read about. That's what people thought. That's like much more of a question for me with the book that I'm working on now, because I'm under contract. I'm working with an editor and she's very, like there was a question at the beginning, of the book being told completely in a male point of view. And she was very much against that because it's not what women read and women, I mean, I don't know that that's true, but it's not, and broadly speaking, it's not what publishers think women read and, women buy most of the books in the world. So that's like something that is like on my mind every day. This is like a very bad thing to think about while I'm writing, but while I'm writing, I'm thinking about Machiko Kakutuni reviewing it, which like, I hope she won't, and my editor was like, she'll hate your first book because she liked your first book. So don't worry about it. But it's like, it's impossible not to have that in your head anymore. And it's totally useless. Like, it's totally useless for me to think about like what some critic is going to think about when they read the book. There's like a question with the ending of the new book. Like, I want a darker ending and my editor is like, I'm not sure, it depends, it could be brilliant or everybody could hate, like she might want like a less dark, like it hasn't gotten there yet, but there are all these considerations that were not around for my first book. That said, I'm like really grateful to be working with an editor, and I would like my book to like sell versus not sell. So, but I also just think it's impossible. Like, when I was floating ideas for my second book, my editor and my agent were like, that just doesn't have enough hook to it and it doesn't sound good. It's like, you've never even seen anything because I haven't even written it. So how do you know? Like, it could be. And like, there are books that are successful that, you know, that don't sound appealing, like if you just like spoke the idea to somebody, but that are totally appealing. So that's a long question. That's a long answer. Something I've been thinking about, obviously. Yeah, Laura. I mean, my first book, it felt so like I had to get it out. Like it felt like passionate in this weird way. My second book feels less passionate, which like that remains to be seen, like whether or not that's a good or bad thing. I feel like the first book, I'm a worrier by nature, and it was hard for me to write. And like it writing was one thing, but my husband and I, he's also a writer, had arranged our whole lives around writing. And we weren't rolling in money is basically what that means. And that the lifestyle was stressful, and it was stressful not knowing if it would come to an end. Like, so it was like doing something endlessly, and I had no idea if there was going to be a payoff at the end. That was stressful. It didn't, like, I think I kept that separate from the writing, but it was definitely a part of it. It's just like this, I mean, that might be one of the reasons that it felt so urgent to write it, because there's like this urgency born of desperation. And then with my second book, it is like, it's like 90% like awesome that I know it's going to be published no matter what. And that it's, like there's an endpoint, and like it's 10%, like it's going to be published if it's bad too. Like, when you sell your first book, you're just, if it's a bad book, it doesn't get bought. And it was your second book, it's just different. So a little bit of both, I guess. It's weird. Like my first book is first person, takes place over a year, and there are flashbacks. Like the structure is very set. And my second book is third person. It goes into a bunch of voices. It takes place over 20 years. So there's like, I feel like I'm like wading into unknown waters, which is exciting. But also, like I told my husband last week, I was like, I just hope it doesn't suck. Like, and it's like, you don't know until you finish it. Like it's, and there's, I think it's good. Like it feels good while I'm writing it, but will it hang together as a whole book? Will there be these like gaping holes? Well, so it's a mixed bag. All right. Yes.
Is there anything about the writing process or your first novel being published that ended up really surprising you, that you didn't sort of, that you were shocked by or surprised by?
I mean, yeah, I was like, I was shocked by everything. So I was like in a perpetual state of shock. I didn't understand what a machine publishing was, and how much goes into the books that you see on the shelf. And like not a machine and a bat. I didn't understand how much bookstores have to do with it, and how much hand selling has to do with it, and how much goes on behind the scenes to like get your book into the hands of a reader. Like I just kind of had this naive idea that like, you know, the good books would float to the top. And like there are so many good books that don't float to the top because they don't get the attention that they deserve. So that surprised me. I mean, it was kind of, which sounds really naive now, but it did, that there's this whole, like so many people worked on my book. And it's like my part was like, seems relatively small like compared to the stuff that everybody else did. Yeah, I guess that was the most surprising thing. Yeah. I try to read books set in third person, or books that are told in third person, and that in third person for like not my former students is just like the he or she. And I try to read books told in the third person and that take place over a long periods of time. Like I try to do that, but then I'm also lazy with myself about doing that. And if a book appeals to me, like I'm like, I'll just read it. And but I do, like I was reading Americana, which I really, really liked. It was so good. And I felt like inspired reading. I mean, my book is like totally different, but she does do third person and it does take place over a long period of time. I mean, her tone is like completely opposite of mine, but you just get ideas. Like just like she had this transition from one scene to like summary. And it was just like, wow, that's so good. And like, how can I figure out how to do that without setting my book in Uganda? And like it's like you take like, you like anything you read, I mean, not like People magazine articles, but which I read a lot of in the airport nowadays, but anything that you read, you just take stuff unconsciously and consciously, I think.
Has your relationship to writing changed Oh, yeah. Like, you just knew of it, but you didn't really want to know of.
Yes.
Which totally makes sense. Are you doing the same thing for the next book? Or
I feel like I'm a really bad researcher. Like, I try to be, like, a good, thorough researcher. I find, like, with Donna Lossie, it's set in the 30s, the 20s and the 30s. I knew nothing about that except, like, the, like, basics. There's a depression, stuff like that. So I wrote it, and then I researched second, which was, I had to change a lot because I would write something that it's like, oh no, actually, like, that wasn't happening with the banks then. And, like, I had to fiddle with things. With this book, it's easier because it's set in the 50s and 60s. So there's a lot, like, there are YouTube videos that I can look at. Like, it's set in Houston, and there's this famous hotel, the Shamrock, which had 53 shades of green in it. And Frank Lloyd Wright was said to have looked at it and gone, why? but I can see that. Like, I can go, like, look at a YouTube video and see somebody, like, going around and, like, see the rooms. And so I've put away research for now because I think I was, like, using it to not write. But then I'm also worried that I'm, like, writing a book that could be set, like, in any, like, there's not enough detail to. It's like, I mean, isn't it just, like, a fine balance of, like, researching? And then I feel like I'd like to not write historical fiction next. It's like, it's just like, write in a world that, like, I know. And then it's also like, nobody was, well, there were people that were alive during the time that Yana Lossie was written, but, like, nobody was saying, like, that didn't happen then, or that, because, well, I didn't get many, I guess I got some emails like that, which are really fun emails to get, like, very careful readers who were like, that did not happen then. How could you put that in there? But mainly there was no, I mean, there were not any, like, 90-year-old women coming to readings and, like, telling me things, but for this book, like, there are plenty of people who, you know, were alive and, you know, conscious of the world. So it's, like, harder, I feel like, because I have to make something real that people remember. So we'll see. Maybe we'll put pictures in it or give links to the YouTube video.
Sorry, I have another question that's not really about writing.
It's okay.
I don't mean to monopolize this for my own personal interest, but in terms of your teaching at WashU, has it, so, like, when I was there,
that's funny because, like, you were my student before my book, and then Laura was my student after my book. I don't think so. Like, I feel like I don't, it's such a, I don't know. I don't, nobody's like, nobody says anything to me. I mean, nobody, like, I haven't noticed, like, an increase in classes. I feel like it's such a small world, like, fiction writing. And, as an undergrad at WashU, you take classes with people who are, like, so accomplished, and so that, like, students are, I mean, they're, like, unimpressed in a way. Like, it's not, and, like, writing is, like, I feel like it, maybe it would be different working with graduate students, but it's so, like, I feel like not a ton of undergrads are like, I want to be an author. Like, it's like, maybe if I were, like, a movie star and teaching in a drama class. I mean, I can talk about publishing more because, but I don't know that that's interesting to anybody but me. Like, but it's like fun to, like, tell stories about things. All right. Yes. That's a good question. I chose it randomly at first. Like, I chose the early 20s actually, and I wanted it to be far enough back that it seemed like an alien world, but I didn't want it to be so far removed that it felt, like, totally alien. Like, I wanted there to be something recognizable in the world. So it seemed, so in that sense, it was a good place to choose it, or it was a good time to choose. I started reading a lot about the Depression then, and the Depression is something that's so, like, everybody knows about it. But not, I don't think many people, like, know this, all the specific histories. So I moved it up to the cusp of the Depression. And for a long time, as I understood when I started reading about it, people were under the impression, and they really believed that things were going to get better. So there was this really hopeful, like, things were really bad, the banks were failing. But you can actually see it, like, I did research into banks in North Carolina, and like a bank would fail, but then 2 months later a bank would do well, and like so people were just like up and down, and that was just a really rich thing, a really rich backdrop for the book. So and it's like that's the beauty of historical fiction, that the reader knows what's going, like the reader understands that things are going to end really badly. Like it's not going to get better in 2 years. It's going to get worse, and it's going to get worse than anybody expected. So that I wanted to set it like before things had gotten absolutely horrible. But I had to do, there's like the big kind of research, like banks failing. And then like I spent a lot of time trying to find like what the fabric cover was for seats and cars. Mohair was the one I came, but like, and that's something you would never, who would think, but it like makes the scene to have like I'm of like the, like, I feel like if there's a historical fiction spectrum, and like Kazuo Ishiguro is like on one end where he's like pretty spare with his historical detail, and like Hilary Mantel, it's like you're reading a history book. I'm like way more on this side. But it's like those little details are so, and you find like Francine Prose wrote an essay in the New York Times, that like blast section that they have where writers talk about things. And she was saying that so much of research is browsing, and so much of the stuff I found that I included in the book was just like, I would be looking for one thing, but then I'd get like a really great detail about something else, and which is fun. So, all right. Thank you for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.